Chapter 11. Man Remakes Himself. 1. The First of the Great Brains. Those who sought to produce a superbrain embarked upon a great enterprise of research and experiment in a remote corner of the planet. It is unnecessary to tell in detail how they fared. Working first in secret, they later strove to persuade the world to approve of their scheme, but only succeeded in dividing mankind into two parties. The body politic was torn asunder. There were religious wars, but after a few centuries of intermittent bloodshed, the two sects, who sought to produce communicants and those who sought the upper brain, settled down in different regions to pursue their respective aims unmolested. In time, each developed into a kind of nation, united by a religious faith and crusading spirit. There was little cultural intercourse between the two. Those who desired to produce the superbrain employed four methods, namely selective breeding, manipulation of the hereditary factors in germ cells cultivated in the laboratory, manipulation of the fertilized ovum, cultivated also in the laboratory, and manipulation of the growing body. At first they produced innumerable tragic abortions. These we need not observe, but at length, several thousand years after the earliest experiments, something was produced which seemed to promise success. A human ovum had been carefully selected, fertilized in the laboratory, and largely reorganized by artificial means. By inhibiting the growth of the embryo's body and the lower organs of the brain itself, and at the same time greatly stimulating the growth of the cerebral hemispheres, the dauntless experimenters succeeded at last in creating an organism which consisted of a brain 12 feet across, and a body most of which was reduced to a mere vestige upon the undersurface of the brain. The only parts of the body which were allowed to attain the natural size were the arms and hands. These sinewy organs of manipulation were induced to key themselves at the shoulders into the solid masonry which formed the creature's house. Thus they were able to get a purchase for their work. The hands were the normal six-fingered hands of the third men, very greatly enlarged and improved. The fantastic organism was generated and matured in a building designed to house both it and the complicated machinery which was necessary to keep it alive. A self-regulating pump, electrically driven, served it as a heart. A chemical factory poured the necessary materials into its blood and removed waste products, thus taking the place of digestive organs and the normal battery of glands. Its lungs consisted of a great room full of oxidizing tubes, through which a constant wind was driven by an electric fan. The same fan forced air through the artificial organs of speech. These organs were so constructed that the natural nerve fibers issuing from the speech centers of the brain could stimulate appropriate electrical controls so as to produce sounds identical with those which they would have produced from a living throat and mouth. The sensory equipment of this trunkless brain was a blend of the natural and the artificial. The optic nerves were induced to grow out along two flexible proboscides, 5 feet long, each of which bore a huge eye at the end. But by a very ingenious alteration of the structure of the eye, the natural lens could be moved aside at will, so that the retina could be applied to any of a great diversity of optical instruments. The ears also could be projected upon stalks, and were so arranged that the actual nerve endings could be brought into contact with artificial resonators of various kinds, or could listen directly to the microscopic rhythms of the most minute organisms. Scent and taste were developed as a chemical sense, which could distinguish almost all compounds and elements by their flavor. Pressure, Warmth and cold were detected only by the fingers, but there with great subtlety. Sensory pain was to have been eliminated from the organism altogether, but this end was not achieved. The creature was successfully launched upon life and was actually kept alive for 4 years. But though at first all went well, in his second year the unfortunate child, if such he may be called, began to suffer severe pain and to show symptoms of mental derangement. In spite of all that his devoted foster parents could do, he gradually sank into insanity and died. He had succumbed to his own brain weight and to certain failures in the chemical regulation of his blood. We may overlook the next 400 years, during which sundry vain attempts were made to repeat the great experiment more successfully. Let us pass on to the first true individual of the fourth human species. He was produced in the same artificial manner as his forerunners, and was designed upon the same general plan. His mechanical and chemical machinery, however, was far more efficient, and his makers expected that owing to careful adjustments of the mechanisms of growth and decay, he would prove to be immortal. His general plan also was changed in one important respect. His makers built a large circular brain turret, which they divided with many partitions, radiating from a central space and covered everywhere with pigeonholes. By a technique which took centuries to develop, they induced the cells of the growing embryonic brain to spread outwards, not as normal hemispheres of convolutions, but into the pigeonholes which had been prepared for them. Thus the artificial cranium had to be a roomy turret of ferro-concrete, some 40 feet in diameter. A door and a passage led from the outer world into the centre of the turret, and thence other passages radiated between tiers of little cupboards. Innumerable tubes of glass, metal, and a kind of vulcanite conveyed blood and chemicals over the whole system. Electric radiators preserved an even warmth in every cupboard and throughout the innumerable carefully protected channels of the nerve fibres. Thermometers, dials, pressure gauges, indicators of all sorts informed the attendants of every physical change in this strange half-natural, half-artificial system, this preposterous factory of mind. 8 years after its inception, the organism had filled its brain room and attained the mentality of a newborn infant. His advance to maturity seemed to his foster parents dishearteningly slow. Not till almost at the end of his fifth decade could he be said to have reached the mental standard of a bright adolescent. But there was no real reason for disappointment. Within another decade, this pioneer of the fourth men had learned all that the third men could teach him, and had also seen that a great part of their wisdom was folly. In manual dexterity, he could already vie with the best. But though manipulation afforded him intense delight, he used his hands almost wholly in service of his tireless curiosity. In fact, it was evident that curiosity was his main characteristic. He was a huge bump of curiosity, equipped with most cunning hands. A Department of State had been created to look after his nurture and education. An army of learned persons was kept in readiness to answer his impatient questions and assist him in his own scientific experiments. Now that he had attained maturity, these unfortunate pundits found themselves hopelessly outclassed and reduced to mere clerks, bottle washers, and errand boys. Hundreds of his servants were forever scurrying into every corner of the planet to seek information and specimens, and the significance of their errands was by now often quite beyond the range of their own intelligence. They were careful, however, not to let their ignorance appear to the public. On the contrary, they succeeded in gaining much prestige from the mere mysteriousness of their errands. The great brain was wholly lacking in all normal instinctive responses, save curiosity and constructiveness. Instinctive fear he knew not, though of course he was capable of cold caution in any circumstances which threatened to damage him and hinder his passionate research. Anger he knew not, but only an adamantine firmness in the face of opposition. Normal hunger and thirst he knew not, but only an experience of faintness when his blood was not properly supplied with nutriment. Sex was wholly absent from his mentality. Instinctive tenderness and instinctive group feeling were not possible to him, for he was without the bowels of mercy. The heroic devotion of his most intimate servants called forth no gratitude, but only cold approval. At first he interested himself not at all in the affairs of the society which maintained him, served his every whim, and adored him. But in time he began to take pleasure in suggesting brilliant solutions of all the current problems of social organization. His advice was increasingly sought and accepted. He became autocrat of the state. His own intelligence and complete detachment combined with the people's superstitious reverence to establish him far more securely than any ordinary tyrant. He cared nothing for the petty troubles of his people, but he was determined to be served by a harmonious, healthy, and potent race. And as relaxation from the more serious excitement of research in physics and astronomy, the study of human nature was not without attractions. It may seem strange that one so completely devoid of human sympathy could have the tact to govern a race of the emotional third men. But he had built up for himself a very accurate behavioristic psychology, and like the skillful master of animals, he knew unerringly how much could be expected of his people, even though their emotions were almost wholly foreign to him. Thus, for instance, while he thoroughly despised their admiration of animals and plants, and their religion of life, he soon learned not to seem hostile to these obsessions, but rather to use them for his own ends. He himself was interested in animals only as material for experiments. In this respect, his people readily helped him, partly because he assured them that his goal was the further improvement of all types, partly because they were fascinated by his complete disregard in his experimentation of the common technique for preventing pain. The orgy of vicarious suffering awakened in his people the long-suppressed lust in cruelty, which, in spite of their intuitive insight into animal nature, was so strong a factor in the third human species. Little by little, the great brain probed the material universe and the universe of mentality. He mastered the principles of biological evolution, and he constructed for his own delight a detailed history of life on Earth. He learned by marvellous archaeological technique the story of all the earlier human peoples and of the Martian episode, matters which had remained hidden from the third men. He discovered the principles of relativity and the quantum theory, the nature of the atom as a complex system of wave trains. He measured the cosmos, and with his delicate instruments, he counted the planetary systems in many of the remote universes. He casually solved, to his own satisfaction at least, the ancient problems of good and evil, of mind and its object, of the one and the many, and of truth and error. He created many new departments of state for the purpose of recording his discoveries in an artificial language which he devised for the purpose. Each department consisted of many colleges of carefully bred and educated specialists who could understand the subject of their own department to some extent, but the coordination of all, and true insight into each, lay with the great brain alone. 2. The Tragedy of the Fourth Men. When some 3,000 years had passed since his beginning, the unique individual determined to create others of his kind. Not that he suffered from loneliness, not that he yearned for love or even for intellectual companionship, but solely for the undertaking of more profound research, he needed the cooperation of beings of his own mental stature. He therefore designed, and had built in various regions of the planet, turrets and factories like his own, though greatly improved. Into each he sent by his servants a cell of his own vestigial body, and directed how it should be cultivated so as to produce a new individual. At the same time, he caused far-reaching operations to be performed upon himself, so that he should be remade upon a more ample plan. Of the new capacities which he inculcated in himself and his progeny, the most important was direct sensitivity to radiation. This was achieved by incorporating in each brain tissue a specially bred strain of Martian parasites. These, henceforth, were to live in the great brain as integral members of each one of its cells. Each brain was also equipped with a powerful wireless transmitting apparatus. Thus should the widely scattered sessile population maintain direct telepathic contact with one another. The undertaking was successfully accomplished. Some 10,000 of these new individuals, each specialized for his particular locality and office, now constituted the fourth men. On the highest mountains were super-astronomers with vast observatories whose instruments were partly artificial, partly natural excrescences of their own brains. In the very entrails of the planet, others, specially adapted to heat, studied the subterranean forces and were kept in telepathic union with the astronomers. In the tropics, in the Arctic, in the forests, the deserts, and on the ocean floor, the fourth men indulged their immense curiosity, and in the homeland around the father of the race, a group of great buildings housed 100 individuals. In the service of this worldwide population, those races of third men which had originally cooperated to produce the new human species tilled the land, tended the cattle, manufactured the immense material requisites of the new civilization, and satisfied their spirits with an ever more stereotyped ritual of their ancient vital art. This degradation of the whole race to a menial position had occurred slowly, imperceptibly, but the result was none the less irksome. Occasionally there were sparks of rebellion. They always failed to kindle serious trouble, for the prestige and persuasiveness of the fourth men were irresistible. At length, however, a crisis occurred. For some 3,000 years the fourth men had pursued their research with constant success. But latterly progress had been slow. It was becoming increasingly difficult to devise new lines of research. True, there was still much detail to be filled in, even in their knowledge of their own planet, and very much in the knowledge of the stars. But there was no prospect of opening up entirely new fields which might throw some light on the essential nature of things. Indeed, it began to dawn on them that they had scarcely plumbed the surface ripple of the ocean of mystery. Their knowledge seemed to them perfectly systematic, yet wholly enigmatic. They had a growing sense that though in a manner they knew almost everything, they really knew nothing. The normal mind, when it experiences intellectual frustration, can seek recreation in companionship or physical exercise, or art. But for the fourth men, there was no such escape. These activities were impossible and meaningless to them. The great brains were wholeheartedly interested in the objective world, but solely as a vast stimulus to intellection, never for its own sake. They admired only the intellective process itself and the interpretive formulae and principles which it devised. They cared no more for men and women than for material in a test tube, no more for one another than for mechanical calculators. Nay, of each one of them it might almost be said that he cared even for himself solely as an instrument of knowing. Many of the species had actually sacrificed their sanity, even in some cases their lives, to the obsessive lust of intellection. As the sense of frustration became more and more oppressive, the fourth men suffered more and more from the one-sidedness of their nature. Though so completely dispassionate, while their intellectual life proceeded smoothly, now that it was thwarted, they began to be confused by foolish whims and cravings which they disguised from themselves under a cloak of excuses. Sessile and incapable of affection, they continually witnessed the free movement, the group life, the love-making of their menials. Such activities became an offence to them, and filled them with a cold jealousy which it was altogether beneath their dignity to notice. The affairs of the serf population began to be conducted by their masters with less than the accustomed justice. Serious grievances arose. The climax occurred in connection with a great revival of research, which, it was said, would break down the impalpable barriers and set knowledge in progress again. The great brains were to be multiplied a thousandfold, and the resources of the whole planet were to be devoted far more strictly than before to the crusade of intellection. The menial third men would therefore have to put up with more work and less pleasure. Formerly, they would willingly have accepted this fate for the glory of serving the superhuman brains, but the days of their blind devotion were past. It was murmured among them that the great experiment of their forefathers had proved a great disaster, and that the fourth men, the great brains, in spite of their devilish cunning, were mere abortions. Matters came to a head when the tyrants announced that all useless animals must be slaughtered, since their upkeep was too great an economic burden upon the world community. The vital art, moreover, was to be practised in future only by the great brains themselves. This announcement threw the third men into violent excitement and divided them into two parties. Many of those whose lives were spent in direct service of the great brains favoured implicit obedience, though even these were deeply distressed. The majority, on the other hand, absolutely refused to permit the imperious slaughter or even to surrender their privileges as vital artists. For they said to kill off the fauna of the planet would be to violate the fair form of the universe by blotting out many of its most beautiful features. It would be an outrage to the life god, and he would surely avenge it. They therefore urged that the time had come for all true human beings to stand together and depose the tyrants, and this, they pointed out, could easily be done. It was only necessary to cut a few electric cables connecting the great brains with the subterranean generating stations. The electric pumps would then cease to supply the brain turrets with aerated blood. Or, in the few cases in which the great brains were so located that they could control their own source of power in wind or water, it was necessary merely to refrain from transporting food to their digestion laboratories. The personal attendants of the great brains shrank from such action, for their whole lives had been devoted proudly, and even in a manner lovingly, to service of the revered beings. But the agriculturists determined to withhold supplies. The great brains, therefore, armed their servitors with a diversity of ingenious weapons. Immense destruction was done. But since the rebels were decimated, there were not enough hands to work the fields. Some of the great brains and many of their servants actually died of starvation. And as hardship increased, the servants themselves began to drift over to the rebels. It now seemed certain to the third men that the great brains would very soon be impotent, and the planet once more under the control of natural beings. But the tyrants were not to be so easily defeated. Already for some centuries they had been secretly experimenting with a means of gaining a far more thorough dominion over the natural species. At the 11th hour they succeeded. In this undertaking they had been favoured by the results which a section of the natural species itself had produced long ago in an effort to breed specialised communicants to keep in touch with the unseen world. That sect, or theocratic nation, which had striven for many centuries towards this goal, had finally attained what they regarded as success. There came into existence an hereditary caste of communicants. Now, though these beings were subject to mediumistic trances in which they apparently conversed with denizens of the other world and received instructions about the ordering of matters terrestrial, they were, in fact, merely abnormally suggestible. Trained from childhood in the lore of the unseen world, their minds, during the trance, were amazingly fertile in developing fantasies based on that lore. Left to themselves, they were merely folk who were abnormally lacking in initiative and intelligence. Indeed, so naive were they, and so sluggish, that they were mentally more like cattle than human beings. Yet, under the influence of suggestion, they became both intelligent and vigorous. Their intelligence, however, operating strictly in service of the suggestion, was wholly incapable of criticizing the suggestion itself. There is no need to revert to the downfall of this theocratic society, beyond saying that since both private and public affairs were regulated by reference to the sayings of the communicants, inevitably the state fell into chaos. The other community of the third men, that which was engaged upon breeding the great brains, gradually dominated the whole planet. The mediumistic stock, however, remained in existence and was treated with a half-contemptuous reverence. The mediums were still generally regarded as in some manner specially gifted with the divine spirit, but they were now thought to be too holy for their sayings to have any relation to mundane affairs. It was by means of this mediumistic stock that the great brains had intended to consolidate their position. Their earlier efforts may be passed over, but in the end they produced a race of living and even intelligent machines whose will they could control absolutely, even at a great distance. For the new variety of third men was telepathically united with its masters. Martian units had been incorporated in its nervous system. At the last moment, the great brains were able to put into the field an army of these perfect slaves, which they equipped with the most efficient lethal weapons. The remnant of original servants discovered too late that they'd been helping to produce their supplanters. They joined the rebels only to share in the general destruction. In a few months, all the third men, save the new docile variety, were destroyed, except for a few specimens which were preserved in cages for experimental purposes. And in a few years, every type of animal that was not known to be directly or indirectly necessary to human life had been exterminated. None were preserved even as specimens, for the great brains had already studied them through and through. But though the great brains were now absolute possessors of the earth, they were, after all, no nearer their goal than before. The actual struggle with the natural species had provided them with an aim. But now that the struggle was over, they began to be obsessed once more with their intellectual failure. With painful clarity, they realized that in spite of their vast weight of neural tissue, in spite of their immense knowledge and cunning, they were practically no nearer the ultimate truth than their predecessors had been. Both were infinitely far from it. For the fourth men, the great brains, there was no possible life but the life of intellect, and the life of intellect had become barren. Evidently something more than mere bulk of brain was needed for the solving of the deeper intellectual problems. They must, therefore, somehow create a new brain quality or organic formation of brain, capable of a mode of vision or insight impossible in their present state. They must learn somehow to remake their own brain tissues upon a new plan. With this aim, and partly through unwitting jealousy of the natural and more balanced species which had created them, they began to use their captive specimens of that species for a great new enterprise of research into the nature of human brain tissue. It was hoped thus to find some hint of the direction in which the new evolutionary leap should take place. The unfortunate specimens were therefore submitted to 1,000 ingenious physiological and psychological tortures. Some were kept alive with their brains spread out permanently on a laboratory table for microscopic observation during their diverse psychological reactions. Others were put into fantastic states of mental abnormality. Others were maintained in perfect health of body and mind, only to be felled at last by some ingeniously contrived tragic experience. New types were produced, which it was hoped might show evidence of emergence into a qualitatively higher mode of mentality. But in fact they succeeded only in ranging through the whole gamut of insanity. The research continued for some thousands of years, but gradually slackened, so utterly barren did it prove to be. As this frustration became more and more evident, a change began to come over the minds of the fourth men. They knew, of course, that the natural species valued many things and activities which they themselves did not appreciate at all. Hitherto, this had seemed a symptom merely of the low mental development of the natural species. But the behaviour of the unfortunate specimens upon whom they'd been experimenting had gradually given the fourth men a greater insight into the likings and admirations of the natural species, so that they had learned to distinguish between those desires which were fundamental and those merely accidental cravings which clear thinking would have dismissed. In fact, they came to see that certain activities and certain objects were appreciated by these beings with the same clear-sighted conviction as they themselves appreciated knowledge. For instance, the natural human beings valued one another and were sometimes capable of sacrificing themselves for the sake of others. They also valued love itself, and again they valued very seriously their artistic activities, and the activities of their bodies and of animal bodies appeared to them to have intrinsic excellence. Little by little the fourth men began to realize that what was wrong with themselves was not merely their intellectual limitation, but far more seriously, the limitation of their insight into values. And this weakness, they saw, was the result not of paucity of intellective brain, but of paucity of body and lower brain tissues. This defect they could not remedy. It was obviously impossible to remake themselves so radically that they should become of a more normal type. Should they concentrate their efforts upon the production of new individuals more harmonious than themselves? Such work, it might be supposed, would have seemed unattractive to them. But no, they argued thus. It is our nature to care most for knowing. Full knowledge is to be attained only by minds both more penetrating and more broadly based than ours. Let us, therefore, waste no more time in seeking to achieve the goal in ourselves. Let us seek rather to produce a kind of being free from our limitations in whom we may attain the goal of perfect knowledge vicariously. The producing of such a being will exercise all our powers and will afford the highest kind of fulfillment possible to us. To refrain from this work would be irrational. Thus it came about that the artificial fourth men began to work in a new spirit upon the surviving specimens of the third men, to produce their own supplanters. 3. The Fifth Men. The plan of the proposed new human being was worked out in great detail before any attempt was made to produce an actual individual. Essentially, he was to be a normal human organism, with all the bodily functions of the natural type, but he was to be perfected through and through. Care must be taken to give him the greatest possible bulk of brain compatible with such a general plan, but no more. Very carefully his creators calculated the dimensions and internal proportions which their creature must have. His brain could not be nearly as large as their own, since he would have to carry it about with him, and maintain it with his own physiological machinery. On the other hand, if it was to be at all larger than the natural brain, the rest of the organism must be proportionately sturdy. Like the second men, the new species must be titanic. Indeed, it must be such as to dwarf even those natural giants. The body, however, must not be so huge as to be seriously hampered by its own weight, and by the necessity of having bones so massive as to be unmanageable. In working out the general proportions of the new man, his makers took into account the possibility of devising more efficient bone and muscle. After some centuries of patient experiment, they did actually invent a means of inducing in germ cells a tendency toward far stronger bone tissues and far more powerful muscle. At the same time, they devised nerve tissues more highly specialized for their particular functions. And in the new brain, so minute compared with their own, smallness was to be compensated for by efficiency of design, both in the individual cells and in their organization. Further, it was found possible to economize somewhat in bulk and vital energy by improvements in the digestive system. Certain new models of microorganisms were produced which, living symbiotically in the human gut, should render the whole process of digestion easier, more rapid, and less erratic. Special attention was given to the system of self-repair in all tissues, especially in those which had hitherto been the earliest to wear out. And, at the same time, the mechanism regulating growth and general senescence was so designed that the new man should reach maturity at the age of 200 years, and should remain in full vigour for at least 3,000 years, when, with the first serious symptom of decay, his heart should suddenly cease functioning. There had been some dispute whether the new being should be endowed with perennial life like his makers, but in the end it had been decided that since he was intended only as a transitional type, it would be safer to allow him only a finite, though a prolonged, lifetime. There must be no possibility that he should be tempted to regard himself as life's final expression. In sensory equipment, the new man was to have all the advantages of the second and third men, and in addition a still wider range and finer discrimination in every sense organ. More important was the incorporation of Martian units in the new model of germ cell. As the organism developed, these should propagate themselves and congregate in the cells of the brain so that every brain area might be sensitive to ethereal vibrations, and the whole might emit a strong system of radiation. But care was taken so that this telepathic faculty of the new species should remain subordinate. There must be no danger that the individual should become a mere resonator of the herd. Long drawn-out chemical research enabled the fourth men to design also far-reaching improvements in the secretions of the new man, so that he should maintain both a perfect physiological equilibrium and a well-balanced temperament. For they were determined that though he should experience all the range of emotional life, his passions should not run into disastrous excess, nor should he be prone to some one emotion in season and out of season. It was necessary also to revise in great detail the whole system of natural reflexes, abolishing some, modifying others, and again strengthening others. All the more complex instinctive responses, which had persisted in man since the days of Pithecanthropus erectus, had also to be meticulously revised, both in respect of the form of the activity and the objects upon which they should be instinctively directed. Anger, fear, curiosity, humour, tenderness, egoism, sexual passion, and sociality must all be possible, but never uncontrollable. In fact, as with the second men, but more emphatically, the new type was to have innate aptitude for and inclination toward all those higher activities and objects which, in the first men, were only achieved after laborious discipline. Thus, while the design included self-regard, it also involved a disposition to prize the self chiefly as a social and intellectual being, rather than as a primeval savage. And while it included strong sociality, the group upon which instinctive interest was to be primarily directed was to be nothing less than the organized community of all minds. And again, while it included vigorous primitive sexuality and parenthood, it provided also those innate sublimations which had occurred in the second species. For instance, the native aptitude for altruistic love of individual spirits of every kind, and for art and religion. Only by a miracle of pure intellectual skill could the cold-natured great brains, who were themselves doomed never to have actual experience of such activities, contrive, merely by study of the third men, to see their importance and to design an organism splendidly capable of them. It was much as though a blind race, after studying physics, should invent organs of sight. It was recognized, of course, that in a race in which the average lifespan should be counted in thousands of years, procreation must be very rare. Yet it was also recognized that for full development of mind, not only sexual intercourse, but parenthood was necessary in both sexes. This difficulty was overcome partly by designing a very prolonged infancy and childhood, which, necessary in themselves for the proper mental and physical growth of these complicated organisms, provided also a longer exercise of parenthood for the mature. At the same time, the actual process of childbirth was designed to be as easy as among the third men. And it was expected that with its greatly improved physiological organization, the infant would not need that anxious and absorbing care which had so seriously hobbled most mothers among the earlier races. The mere sketching out of these preliminary specifications of an improved human being involved many centuries of research and calculation which taxed even the ingenuity of the great brains. Then followed a lengthy period of tentative experiment in the actual production of such a type. For some thousands of years, little was done but to show that many promising lines of attack were after all barren. And several times during this period, the whole work was held up by disagreements among the great brains themselves as to the policy to be adopted. Once, indeed, they took to violence, one party attacking the other with chemicals, microbes, and armies of human automata. In short, it was only after many failures and after many barren epochs, during which, for a variety of reasons, the enterprise was neglected, that the fourth men did at length fashion two individuals almost precisely of the type they had originally designed. These were produced from a single fertilized ovum in laboratory conditions. Identical twins, but of opposite sexes, they became the Adam and Eve of a new and glorious human species, the fifth men. It may fittingly be said of the fifth men that they were the first to attain true human proportions of body and mind. On the average, they were more than twice as tall as the first men, and much taller than the second men, Their lower limbs had therefore to be extremely massive compared with the torso which they had to support. Thus, upon the ample pedestal of their feet, they stood like columns of masonry. Yet though their proportions were in a manner elephantine, there was a remarkable precision and even delicacy in the volumes that composed them. Their great arms and shoulders, dwarfed somewhat by their still mightier legs, were instruments not only of power, but also of fine adjustment. Their hands also were fashioned both for power and for minute control. For while the thumb and forefinger constituted a formidable vice, the delicate sixth finger had been induced to divide its tip into two Lilliputian fingers and a corresponding thumb. The contours of the limbs were sharply visible, for the body bore no hair save for a close, thick skull-cap, which in the original stock was of ruddy brown. The well-marked eyebrows, when drawn down, shaded the sensitive eyes from the sun. Elsewhere there was no need of hair, for the brown skin had been so ingeniously contrived that it maintained an even temperature alike in tropical and sub-Arctic climates, with no aid either from hair or clothes. Compared with the great body, the head was not large, though the brain capacity was twice that of the second men. In the original pair of individuals, the immense eyes were of a deep violet, the features strongly moulded and mobile. These facial characters had not been specially designed, for they seemed unimportant to the fourth men, but the play of biological forces resulted in a face not unlike that of the second men, though with an added and indescribable expression which no human face had hitherto attained. How from this pair of individuals the new population gradually arose, how at first it was earnestly fostered by its creators, how it subsequently asserted its independence and took control of its own destiny, how the great brains failed piteously to understand and sympathize with the mentality of their creatures and tried to tyrannize over them, how for a while the planet was divided into two mutually intolerant communities and was at last drenched with man's blood until the human automata were exterminated, the great brains starved or blown to pieces, and the fifth men themselves decimated. How, as a result of these events, a dense fog of barbarism settled once more upon the planet, so that the fifth men, like so many other races, had after all to start rebuilding civilization and culture from its very foundations. How all these things befell, we must not in detail observe. 4. The culture of the fifth men. It is not possible to recount the stages by which the fifth men advanced toward their greatest civilization and culture, for it is that fully developed culture itself which concerns us, and even of their highest achievement, which persisted for so many millions of years, I can say but little, not merely because I must hasten to the end of my story, but also because so much of that achievement lies wholly beyond the comprehension of those for whom this book is intended. For I have at last reached that period in the history of man when he first began to reorganize his whole mentality to cope with matters whose very existence had been hitherto almost completely hidden from him. The old aims persist and are progressively realized as never before, but also they become increasingly subordinate to the requirements of new aims which are more and more insistently forced upon him by his deepening experience. Just as the interests and ideals of the first men lie beyond the grasp of their ape contemporaries, so the interests and ideals of the fifth men in their full development lie beyond the grasp of the first men. On the other hand, just as in the life of primitive men there is much which would be meaningful even to the ape, so in the life of the fifth men much remains which is meaningful even to the first men. Conceive a world society developed materially far beyond the wildest dreams of America. Unlimited power, derived partly from the artificial disintegration of atoms, partly from the actual annihilation of matter through the union of electrons and protons to form radiation, completely abolished the whole grotesque burden of drudgery, which hitherto had seemed the inescapable price of civilization, nay, of life itself. The vast economic routine of the world community was carried on by the mere touching of appropriate buttons. Transport, mining, manufacture, and even agriculture were performed in this manner. And indeed, in most cases, the systematic coordination of these activities was itself the work of self-regulating machinery. Thus, not only was there no longer need for any human beings to spend their lives in unskilled, monotonous labour, but further, much that earlier races would have regarded as highly skilled, though stereotyped, work was now carried on by machinery. Only the pioneering of industry, the endless, exhilarating research, invention, design, and reorganization which is incurred by an ever-changing society still engaged the minds of men and women. And though this work was of course immense, it could not occupy the whole attention of a great world community. Thus very much of the energy of the race was free to occupy itself with other no less difficult and exacting matters, or to seek recreation in its many admirable sports and arts. Materially, every individual was a multimillionaire, in that he had at his beck and call a great diversity of powerful mechanisms. But also he was a penniless friar, for he had no vestige of economic control over any other human being. He could fly through the upper air to the ends of the earth in an hour, or hang idle among the clouds all day long. His flying machine was no cumbersome aeroplane, but either a wingless aerial boat or a mere suit of overalls in which he could disport himself with the freedom of a bird. Not only in the air, but in the sea also, he was free. He could stroll about the ocean bed or gambol with the deep sea fishes. And for habitation, he could make his home as he willed, either in a shack in the wilderness or in one of the great pylons which dwarf the architecture even of the American age. He could possess this huge palace in loneliness and fill it with his possessions, to be automatically cared for without human service. Or he could join with others and create a hive of social life. All these amenities he took for granted as the savage takes for granted the air which he breathes. And because they were as universally available as air, no one craved them in excess, and no one grudged another the use of them. Yet the population of the earth was now very numerous. Some 10,000 million persons had their homes in the snow-capped pylons which covered the continents with an open forest of architecture. Between these great obelisks lay cornland, park, and wilderness, for there were very many areas of hill country and forest which were preserved as playgrounds. And indeed, one whole continent stretching from the tropical to the Arctic was kept as nearly as possible in its natural state. This region was chosen mainly for its mountains, for since most of the alpine tracts had by now been worn into insignificance by water and frost, mountains were much prized. Into this wild continent, individuals of all ages repaired to spend many years at a time in living the life of primitive man without any aid whatever from civilization. For it was recognized that a highly sophisticated race, devoted almost wholly to art and science, must take special measures to preserve its contact with the primitive. Thus in the wild continent was to be found at any time a sparse population of savages, armed with flint and bone, or more rarely with iron, which they or their friends had wrested from the earth. These voluntary primitives were intent chiefly upon hunting and simple agriculture. Their scanty leisure was devoted to art and meditation, and to savouring fully all the primeval human values. Indeed, it was a hard life and a dangerous that these intellectuals periodically imposed on themselves. And though, of course, they had zest in it, they often dreaded its hardship and the uncertainty that they would ever return from it. For the danger was very real. The fifth men had compensated for the fourth men's foolish destruction of the animals by creating a whole system of new types which they set at large in the wild continent, and some of these creatures were extremely formidable carnivora, which man himself, armed only with primitive weapons, had very good reason to fear. In the wild continent there was inevitably a high death rate. Many promising lives were tragically cut short. But it was recognized that from the point of view of the race, this sacrifice was worthwhile, for the spiritual effects of the institution of periodic savagery were very real. Beings whose natural span was 3,000 years, given over almost wholly to civilized pursuits, were greatly invigorated and enlightened by an occasional decade in the wild. The culture of the fifth men was influenced in many respects by their telepathic communication with one another. The obvious advantages of this capacity were now secured without its dangers. Each individual could isolate himself at will from the radiation of his fellows, either wholly or in respect of particular elements of his mental process, and thus he was in no danger of losing his individuality. But on the other hand, he was immeasurably more able to participate in the experience of others than were beings for whom the only possible communication was symbolic. The result was that though conflict of wills was still possible, it was far more easily resolved by mutual understanding than had ever been the case in earlier species. Thus, there were no lasting and no radical conflicts either of thought or desire. It was universally recognized that every discrepancy of opinion and of aim could be abolished by telepathic discussion. Sometimes the process would be easy and rapid. Sometimes it could not be achieved without a patient and detailed laying of mind to mind, so as to bring to light the point where the difference originated. One result of the general telepathic facility of the species was that speech was no longer necessary. It was still preserved and prized, but only as a medium of art, not as a means of communication. Thinking, of course, was still carried on largely by means of words, but in communication there was no more need actually to speak the words than in thinking in private. Written language remained essential for the recording and storing of thought. Both language and the written expression of it had become far more complex and accurate than they had ever been, more faithful instruments for the expression and creation of thought and emotion. Telepathy, combined with longevity and the extremely subtle brain structure of the species, to afford each individual an immense number of intimate friendships and some slight acquaintance actually with the whole race. This, I fear, must seem incredible to my readers, unless they can be persuaded to regard it as a symptom of the high mental development of the species. However that may be, it is a fact that each person was aware of every other, at least as a face, or a name, or the holder of a certain office. It is impossible to exaggerate the effects of this facility of personal intercourse. It meant that the species constituted at any moment, if not strictly a community of friends, at least a vast club or college. Further, since each individual saw his own mind reflected, as it were, in very many other minds, and since there was great variety of psychological types, the upshot in each individual was a very accurate self-consciousness. In the Martians, telepathic intercourse had resulted in a true group mind, a single psychical process embodied in the electromagnetic radiation of the whole race. But this group mind was inferior in caliber to the individual minds. All that was distinctive of an individual at his best failed to contribute to the group mind. But in the fifth human species, telepathy was only a means of intercourse between individuals. There was no true group mind. On the other hand, telepathic intercourse occurred even on the highest planes of experience. It was by telepathic intercourse in respect of art, science, philosophy, and the appreciation of personalities that the public mind, or rather the public culture, of the fifth men had being. With the Martians, telepathic union took place chiefly by the elimination of the differences between individuals. With the fifth men, telepathic communication was, as it were, a kind of spiritual multiplication of mental diversity, by which each mind was enriched with the wealth of 10,000 million. Consequently, each individual was, in a very real sense, the cultured mind of the species. But there were as many such minds as there were individuals. There was no additional racial mind over and above the minds of the individuals. Each individual himself was a conscious centre which participated in and contributed to the experience of all other centres. This state of affairs would not have been possible had not the world community been able to direct so much of its interest and energy into the higher mental activities. The whole structure of society was fashioned in relation to its best culture. It is almost impossible to give even an inkling of the nature and aims of this culture, and to make it believable that a huge population should have spent scores of millions of years not wholly, not even chiefly, on industrial advancement, but almost entirely on art, science, and philosophy, without ever repeating itself or falling into ennui. I can only point out that the higher a mind's development, the more it discovers in the universe to occupy it. Needless to say, the fifth men had early mastered all those paradoxes of physical science which had so perplexed the first men. Needless to say, they had a very complete knowledge of the geography of the cosmos and of the atom. But again and again, the very foundations of their science were shattered by some new discovery, so that they had patiently to reconstruct the whole upon an entirely new plan. At length, however, with the clear formulation of the principles of psychophysics, in which the older psychology and the older physics were held, so to speak, in chemical combination, they seemed to have built upon the rock. In this science, the fundamental concepts of psychology were given a physical meaning, and the fundamental concepts of physics were stated in a psychological manner. Further, the most fundamental relations of the physical universe were found to be of the same nature as the fundamental principles of art. But, and herein lay mystery and horror, even for the fifth men, there was no shred of evidence that this aesthetically admirable cosmos was the work of a conscious artist, nor yet that any mind would ever develop so greatly as to be able to appreciate the whole in all its detail and unity. Since art seemed to the fifth men to be in some sense basic to the cosmos, they were naturally very much preoccupied with artistic creation. Consequently, all those who were not social or economic organizers, or scientific researchers, or pure philosophers, were by profession creative artists or handicraftsmen. That is to say, they were engaged on the production of material objects of various kinds whose form should be aesthetically significant to the perceiver. In some cases, the material object was a pattern of spoken words, in others pure music, in others moving coloured shapes, in others a complex of steel cubes and bars, in others, some translation of the human figure into a particular medium, and so on. But also the aesthetic impulse expressed itself in the production by hand of innumerable common utensils, indulging sometimes in lavish decoration, trusting at other times to the beauty of function. Every medium of art that had ever been employed was employed by the fifth men, and innumerable new vehicles were also used. They prized on the whole more highly those kinds of art which were not static, but involved time as well as space, for as a race they were peculiarly fascinated by time. These innumerable artists held that they were doing something of great importance. The cosmos was to be regarded as an aesthetic unity in four dimensions and of inconceivable complexity. Human works of pure art were thought of as instruments through which man might behold and admire some aspect of the cosmic beauty. They were said to focus together features of the cosmos too vast and elusive for man otherwise to apprehend their form. The work of art was sometimes likened to a compendious mathematical formula expressive of some immense and apparently chaotic field of facts. But in the case of art, it was said, the unity which the artistic object elicited was one in which factors of vital nature and of mind itself were essential members. The race thus deemed itself to be engaged upon a great enterprise both of discovery and creation, in which each individual was both an originator of some unique contribution and an appraiser of all. Now, as the years advanced in millions and in decades of millions, it began to be noticed that the movement of world culture was in a manner spiral. There would be an age during which the interest of the race was directed almost wholly upon certain tracts or aspects of existence. And then, after perhaps 100,000 years, these would seem to have been fully cultivated and would be left fallow. During the next epoch, attention would be in the main directed to other spheres, and then afterwards to yet others, and again others. But at length a return would be made to the fields that had been deserted, and it would be discovered that they could now miraculously bear a millionfold the former crop. Thus, in both science and art, man kept recurring again and again to the ancient themes, to work over them once more in meticulous detail and strike from them new truth and new beauty, such as, in the earlier epoch, he could never have conceived. Thus it was that though science gathered to itself unfalteringly an even wider and more detailed view of existence, it periodically discovered some revolutionary general principle in terms of which its whole content had to be given a new significance. And in art there would appear in one age works superficially almost identical with works of another age, yet to the discerning eye incomparably more significant. Similarly, in respect of human personality itself, those men and women who lived at the close of the aeon of the fifth men could often discover in the remote beginning of their own race beings curiously like themselves, yet, as it were, expressed in fewer dimensions than their own many-dimensional natures. As a map is like the mountainous land, or the picture like the landscape, or indeed as the point and the circle are like the sphere, so, and only so, the earlier fifth men resembled the flower of the species. Such statements would be in a manner true of any period of steady cultural progress, but, in the present instance, they have a peculiar significance which I must now somehow contrive to suggest.